The world's closest brush with nuclear war came 40 years ago this month when the U.S. government learned the Soviet Union had nuclear missiles in Cuba aimed at American cities. After President Kennedy demanded that the missiles be removed, the superpowers prepared for war. Some of the people who played key roles in the missile crisis are meeting in Havana today to reflect on the experience and its relevance now. The Bush administration has said John Kennedy's handling of the missile crisis was an example of preemptive action like the Bush administration may soon take against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Others say the crisis shows how war can be avoided. NPR's Tom Jaltum reports.
Cuba may seem like a sideshow today, but in the fall of 1962, it was at the front of U.S. foreign policy concerns. This was the peak of the Cold War, and just 90 miles off the Florida coast, Fidel Castro had aligned his country with the Soviet Union. A year earlier, the U.S. government had sponsored the unsuccessful Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. James Blight of Brown University says Americans were primed to see Fidel Castro as their enemy.
People who were born since the Cuban Missile Crisis don't remember Fidel Castro's reputation in many American circles at the time. Frankly, it wasn't that much different from Saddam Hussein. He was regarded as a brutal dictator. He had seized American property. He was the devil incarnate.
Thousands of Soviet troops were in Cuba by that fall, and the Kennedy administration was deciding how to respond. And then a discovery that sent tensions through the roof. On October 14th, an American reconnaissance plane spotted medium-range missile sites. The Soviets were preparing installations that could be used for a nuclear strike on the United States. 8 days later, President Kennedy went on television to report the news.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
What Kennedy did not tell Americans that night was how close they were to war already at that point. The president's national security team had been discussing their options in Cuba, and military action of some type had been at the top of the list. Airstrikes, possibly a ground invasion. Unlike the Bay of Pigs invasion a year earlier, this one would have been led by U.S. forces. It would have brought direct combat with the Soviet troops on the island and quite possibly triggered the use of nuclear weapons. War would be avoided only if one side or the other backed down. On October 25th, Kennedy's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, challenged Soviet Ambassador V.A. Zorin to declare again that the Soviet Union had no medium-range missile sites in Cuba, as it had previously claimed.
You're in the court of world opinion right now, and you can answer yes or no. You have denied that they exist. I want to know if I've understood you correctly.
Continue your statement, please. You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
After first favoring a military strike in Cuba, President Kennedy settled on a naval quarantine. U.S. ships around Cuba would halt incoming Soviet ships to see whether they carried nuclear weapons. In the end, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles from Cuba in exchange for a U.S. promise not to invade the country again. In the American view, Kennedy and Khrushchev had gone eye to eye, and Khrushchev blinked. The story of the Cuban Missile Crisis has been told in Washington again these days. To Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, John Kennedy's action in getting the missiles removed sounds like an example of the Bush administration's new security strategy under which the United States might act preemptively against a threatening country before that country actually does anything against the United States.
In my view, establishing what he called a quarantine and preventing, if you will, the Soviet Union from placing nuclear missiles in Cuba was certainly preventative, and I think it's not unfair or inaccurate to say that he engaged in preemption.
In his speech on Iraq this week, President Bush justified his administration's willingness to move preemptively against Saddam Hussein by citing a statement President Kennedy made during the missile crisis that, quote, "We no longer live in a world where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril." But tape recordings of the Oval Office conversations during the 1962 crisis show President Kennedy considered and rejected advice that the United States remove the missiles through military action. On October 19th, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Maxwell Taylor, can be heard saying U.S. credibility will be sacrificed if the United States does not act. The Air Force Chief, General Curtis LeMay, agrees. I'd emphasize, LeMay says, that we don't have any choice except direct military action. But President Kennedy wants to think the situation through. If the United States attacks the Soviet forces in Cuba, the Soviets are likely to retaliate against U.S. troops in Berlin. And then what happens? It's then general war, says National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy. Kennedy. You mean a nuclear exchange? Kennedy's clarification of this point, that nuclear war was likely, impresses Brown University's James Blight, a longtime student of the missile crisis.
Once that was said, the conversation became a completely different kind of conversation. We were no longer talking about a one-shot deal where you send in a bunch of airplanes and bomb a bunch of sites and then nothing happens. Now we were talking about the problem of escalation to nuclear holocaust. And the conversation is much different after that. And at many stages, it was Kennedy himself who asked the question, and what will happen next? Now, I know we have this certain capability, but what will happen next?
In the end, there was a compromise, part of which was kept secret. In exchange for the removal of the Soviet missiles, the United States agreed not only not to invade Cuba again, but also to remove U.S. missiles from Turkey, which bordered the Soviet Union. John Lewis Gaddis, a Cold War historian, says the key point about the missile crisis is what Kennedy did not do. And that's the example Gaddis would apply to today's debate about preemption.
In the missile crisis, at a period of maximum danger for the United States, the option of preemption was discussed. It would have taken the form of taking out the Soviet missiles in Cuba, but it was rejected.
Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy responded to President Bush's quoting his older brother this week by saying John Kennedy showed restraint during the missile crisis. He suggested if President Bush wants to follow the Kennedy example, he'll show similar restraint in dealing with Iraq. The evidence on Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, for that matter, is less clear than what Kennedy saw in Cuba. Administration supporters, on the other hand, say the key point about John Kennedy's action in 1962 is that he did not stand by passively and allow Soviet missiles to be installed in Cuba. He chose to do something, says Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations.
And what he chose to do was a military action that could have easily sparked a much larger war. He saw the activation of those missiles as a looming threat to the United States, and he sent out the U.S. Navy to quote-unquote quarantine Cuba and to cut off Russian ships that were supplying more of those missiles.
The gravity of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the fact that the world's fate hinged on how it was resolved, means the events of October 1962 will be debated for decades. It'll be discussed here in Havana this weekend. John Kennedy's defense secretary, Robert McNamara, his advisor, Arthur Schlesinger, and other key figures from both the U.S. and Russian sides will gather to go over what happened 40 years ago. They arrived last night and hold their first meeting here today. Fidel Castro, of course, is still in power. He's hosting the gathering. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Havana.